ignore Europe's modern background, we are bound to misunderstand what is happening in continental Europe today and why. I'd like to go back to the ancient prophet Daniel, who is mentioned in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. He was a young captive, was brought to Babylonia by the Babylonians after they had conquered and destroyed the ancient city of Jerusalem. Now I have passed out some handouts, and those of you who are listening in over the internet, if you have available a copy of the booklet Europe in Prophecy, you might want to go to that booklet and go to the middle portion of it, because that handout is also included in that booklet. It might be easier, perhaps by looking at that handout, to follow through with the lecture as I'm going to present it tonight. Because you see, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, had wondered about what would happen in the future. What would happen after his reign? He wanted to know, as many of us want to know today, what the future holds. Now, he had a dream, and only Daniel was able to explain and to relate the dream to him. And so in the second chapter in the book of Daniel, he is going to first of all tell the king what he had dreamt. And let me just read to you from the Bible what he said. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while the stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet. Notice this, on its feet of iron and clay, and broke them in pieces. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now that was a dream. And then Daniel proceeded to explain to the king the meaning of the dream. And he said, you, king, are a king of kings. The God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. You are this head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar was pictured in this image as a king, or the king, of the first world ruling empire from that time forward. In other words, of the Neo-Babylonian or Chaldean Empire. But you see, this dream wasn't just about Nebuchadnezzar, because it also pictured events which would happen after Nebuchadnezzar's death. And so Daniel continued, after you shall arise another kingdom, inferior to yours. And remember the statute, now you think in terms of the chest of arms and arms of silver. And then he goes on to say, and then there will be still another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And again, the statue had belly and thighs of bronze. And then he said, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, and it shall crush all others. And you might think of the legs of iron in that statue Nebuchadnezzar had seen. The stone which struck the 10 toes of the statues, and I go well ahead in the story right now, is none other as the Messiah, Jesus Christ, who is referred to in the Bible as the rock. And he is the one who will become a great mountain, that is, his government on earth will become great or all encompassing. So what this dream depicts then is the fact that there would only be four successive world ruling empires in history in the part of the world covering that territory from the time of Daniel. Only four. Now, the first one, as we have seen, was the Neo-Babylonian Empire. What was the second one in that dream? The answer is found in the fifth chapter in the book of Daniel. Because the famous Babylonian king Belshazzar, who was a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, gave once a feast. And during that feast, he desecrated the holy things taken from the temple in Jerusalem. And then we are told about this famous handwriting on the wall. There was his hand, the fingers of a hand, which was writing down the famous words, Mini, Mini, Tekel, Upharsin. And nobody could understand what it meant until Daniel, who was now an old man, was called in, and he explained to this king Belshazzar that God had decreed that the kingdom would be taken away from him and that it would be given to the Medes and the Persians. That same night, we are told, Belshazzar was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. So we see then that the arms of the statue which Nebuchadnezzar had seen in this dream represented the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. So we have identified the first two kingdoms, but now what is the third? In Daniel 8, God gave Daniel a vision. In that vision he saw a ram with two horns. That second horn came up later and was higher than the first. That ram was a conquering animal, and no animal could withstand it until a male goat with one horn very swiftly entered the scene. It attacked the ram, cast it down to the ground, trampled it underfoot, and then this goat became a great one. One of its horn was plucked out, and four horns came up instead. Now that was the vision, and again, Daniel couldn't understand it. You and I couldn't understand it, what that meant. It had to be explained. And in this case, God sent the archangel Gabriel to Daniel to explain to him the vision. Now, Gabriel was later sent to Mary, of course, when Jesus Christ was to be born. And here, Gabriel explained the vision to Daniel as follows. He said, "The ram which you saw, having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia." Now, as we saw, when Babylon was conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire, the conquering kingdom was first ruled by Darius the Mede, but later the Persian side of the kingdom became more powerful, which is why the second horn, which came later, became also then greater as the first one. So it's clear then that the goat, which trampled the ram, symbolized the third world-ruling empire. Now, what again did the goat represent? We don't have to guess, because we are being told in the same chapter, the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. Now, when we study history, we find that Greece, after its takeover by the Macedonians, did subdue and did conquer the Medo-Persian Empire. And that would make its most powerful king, Alexander the Great, the large horn in Daniel's vision. Indeed, when Alexander later visited Judea, he would be shown this account in the book of Daniel, and he acknowledged that this prophecy was about him. But the angel Gabriel went on to explain that after Alexander's death, his empire would be divided among four powers, because he went on to say, and I quote, "Four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its same power." And again, history confirms that after Alexander died, the empire ended up divided among four of his generals. And they have certain names, and I'm not going to go into all of them right now, but that is what history tells us. So the Macedonian Empire, Greco-Macedonian Empire, after Alexander's death, was divided amongst four of his generals. Which means that we have now identified the first three world-ruling empires in Daniel's dream, the Neo-Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, and the Greco-Macedonian Empire. But there's still a fourth one. The fourth one which would last until the return of the Messiah. Now, what is that fourth kingdom? Again, we don't have to guess, because in the seventh chapter in the book of Daniel, God gave Daniel another dream. This one involving four great beasts coming up from the sea. And an angel, perhaps the Archangel Gabriel, perhaps another angel, came and explained to Daniel what that dream meant. He said the first beast was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till the wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now this clearly describes the Babylonian Empire, which by the way was symbolized at the time with a lion. And it symbolizes also, in this case, the first powerful king, Nebuchadnezzar, because, as you might recall the story, because of his pride, Nebuchadnezzar became insane for 7 years, living like an animal, until God restored his sanity. This restoration in this vision here is symbolized by the heart of a man given to the beast, and by the fact that it is now standing like a man, having previously lived like an animal. And then Daniel describes the second beast as a bear. And as we already know, the second empire following that of Nebuchadnezzar was, of course, that of the Medo-Persian Empire. So the bear now then represents the second world ruling empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. Then comes the third beast, which is described as a leopard. It says, "And I looked, there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it." Now we have seen that the third empire was that of the Greco-Macedonian Empire. The wings of the bird showed how swiftly Alexander conquered the world. So swiftly that he died in despair because he couldn't conquer anything anymore. It was known at that time. The four heads of the beast then of course referred to the four generals among whom the empire became divided after Alexander's death. Remember, the goat with the four horns symbolizes the same thing. So now we have again identified the first three kingdoms, but what about the fourth, which was symbolized in Nebuchadnezzar's dream by legs made of iron? Now here in chapter 7, the vision goes on to explain and describes that fourth beast, symbolizing the fourth empire. It says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth." Here you have the symbolism of iron again. "It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now the meaning is explained in the same chapter. It says, "The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings which shall arise from this kingdom." So the beast with the 10 horns, with the iron teeth, would be different from the previous kingdoms, because 10 kings or kingdoms would arise from it. That didn't happen insofar as the other empires were concerned. Now, historically, what kingdom, what empire replaced the Greek Empire and its four divisions? Well, of course, history tells us it was none other than the Empire of Rome, the Roman Empire. The fourth beast which Daniel saw in his vision with its iron teeth symbolizes the fourth world ruling empire, that of the Roman Empire, which would last, according to the vision, the dream which Nebuchadnezzar had, until the return of Jesus Christ. But how could that be? How could that be? We all know Rome fell. The Roman Empire is long gone, isn't it? Well, the interesting thing is that Daniel says that 10 kings or kingdoms would arise from it. And as we will see, the ancient Roman Empire would be renewed or revived 10 times in 10 resurrections, as you please, all the way up until the time of Christ's return. And that is why what is important for us today, because what we are experiencing right now in continental Europe is the very last, the very tenth of those 10 resurrections. As we will see tonight in this lecture. That's why it's critical to watch and to understand what is happening on the world scenes. Before we go into what is happening in Europe right now, let us also turn to the book of Revelation. Because in Revelation, Jesus Christ revealed end-time events to the Apostle John. Like Daniel, John also sees peculiar-looking beasts which symbolize world-ruling empires. And John describes what he saw in one of those visions in Revelation chapter 13 as follows. He says, "I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on its heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion." Now the parallels with the four beasts which Daniel had seen are of course remarkable. Remember, the first beast in Daniel's vision was a lion, like a lion, the second like a bear, and the third like a leopard. Here John sees one beast, but it combines all the elements of what Daniel had seen. In addition, it had 7 heads. Now if you count the beasts which Daniel saw, you will get 7 heads. 1 head of a lion, 1 head of a bear, 4 heads of the leopard, and of course, and 1 head of the fourth beast, makes 7. So John sees one beast with seven heads, showing that it kind of has accumulated all the elements of the previous beasts which Daniel had seen. So what John saw was the Roman Empire. It had swallowed up the previous three kingdoms, the Babylonian kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, the Greco-Macedonian kingdom. They all already appeared and had gone, but their territory and their characteristics had been absorbed by Rome. Now notice what Revelation 13 goes on to tell us. It says, I saw one of its heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and the deadly wound was healed. Now we all know that the Roman Empire fell, and the world believed it would never rise again, which is of course symbolized here by the deadly wound. But God revealed through Daniel, he revealed through John, that there actually would be revivals of the Roman Empire, in fact, 10 of them, 9 of which we know now have already occurred. And let's quickly go through the history of what happened. You see, after the destruction of Rome, 3 so-called barbarian powers, they were all followers of an unorthodox Christian faction called Arianism, revived the Roman Empire. That happened under King Gaiseric of the Vandals, King Odoacer of the Heruli, and King Theodoric of the Ostrogoths. The 4th resurrection or revival of this ancient Roman Empire occurred under Emperor Justinian in AD 554. You see, at that time, lands of the old West Roman Empire were taken back from the Arian, quote-unquote, barbarians by the Romans of the Eastern Empire, because at that time Rome was divided. You had the East Roman Empire and the West Roman Empire. And Justinian was the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, but he combined the two fractions, you might say those two legs, in the vision of Nebuchadnezzar. And he also restored the rule of quote-unquote Orthodox Christianity to the West. This is actually known in history as the Imperial Restoration, which occurred in AD 554. The 5th resurrection occurred under Charlemagne, Charles the Great, or Karl der Große, as he's called in Germany, which happened in AD 800. The 6th under Otto the Great in AD 962. The 7th under Charles V of Habsburg in 1530. The 8th under Napoleon Bonaparte, who ruled from 1804 until 1814. And the 9th has already occurred as well, surprisingly perhaps to some, but I will explain it tonight, under Mussolini and Adolf Hitler. The 10th resurrection, the last one, is occurring right now in Europe. So let's talk a little bit about that. How can I say that? What's the basis for that claim? First of all, let me point out that the politicians in Europe who are trying to put Europe together, to unify it, know that they are resurrecting the ancient Roman Empire. On October 29, 2004, the member states of the EU, the European Union, signed the EU Constitution. Now, we understand and we know that it wasn't ratified by all member states because some of the nations, like France, objected to it, and so it didn't become law. Nevertheless, it's interesting where that EU Constitution was actually signed. The EU Observer, which is a magazine reporting about things which are happening in Europe, wrote on October 29, 2004, and I quote, symbolically, the ceremony took place in the same room as the signing of the original Treaty of Rome by the then 6 original member states in 1957. That's when the original Treaty of Rome was signed. And the original member states were France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. So this original Treaty of Rome, which was signed in 1957, gave birth to the unification of Europe. Der Stern Online, which is a German magazine, wrote that the first Roman treaty signalized, quote, the beginning of the success story of Europe. But the Constitution failed. It wasn't ratified by all the member states. And so it was, quote-unquote, resurrected or revived under a different name. It's known now as the Treaty of Lisbon. But even that Treaty of Lisbon may or may not come into fruition because the Irish people refused to ratify it. And unless Europe is successful in persuading the Irish to accept the Lisbon Treaty, which may or may not happen, that treaty is dead too. But the idea of a united Europe is very much alive. And it is interesting that if even the Treaty of Lisbon fails, it would only fail because the Irish people didn't ratify it. The European politicians are all very much determined to bring about a United States of Europe. And ultimately, as the Bible shows us, they will be successful. Because Europe is destined to become a superpower. The dream of a united, modern Europe has been around for a long time. Again, I'm quoting from the magazine Der Stern, dated March 25, 2004, saying, Voltaire said in 1767 that Europe will become a great republic of cultivated spirits. Shortly thereafter, Immanuel Kant spoke of a European house. In 1849, Victor Hugo coined enthusiastically the phrase United States of Europe, a slogan that was later used by Winston Churchill during a speech in 1943. But things really began to take shape when the euro, the European currency, was introduced. And that happened on January 1, 1999, less than 10 years ago, if you think about it. Today, it's already the most powerful currency in the world. Business Week wrote on May 4, 1998, the euro will turn Europe into a superpower. National Review wrote in October of 1998 that monetary union is first and foremost a, notice, political project. French officials cite the euro as a means by which to develop a global political counterweight to the world's only superpower, the United States. Former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt that is, said, and I quote, the arrival of the euro will change the whole world situation so that the United States can no longer call all the shots. Giving you a little bit of an indication already where that is leading. I'll talk about that some more later on in the program here. But Newsweek wrote in late 1998, and I quote, in January of 1999, they're talking about, the world will start getting used to a new currency. Whether you love the euro or hate it, know this, nothing so big has ever happened before. On May 1, 2004, the 25 member states at that time, now it's 27, but in 2004 we had 25, they celebrated the coming unification of Europe. And again, Der Stern wrote, great Europe is to become a world power, economically, culturally, and perhaps even militarily. Mark Leonard wrote a book in 2005, which is titled, Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century. And that's what he wrote. By creating the largest single internal market in the world, let me repeat this, by creating the largest single internal market in the world, Europe has become an economic giant that, according to some calculations, is already the biggest in the world. The EU Observer added on July 16, 2008. In 2005, the US was supplanted as the world's largest single market by the EU. Many American firms suddenly had this new beast to deal with, the EU. And a beast it is, biblically speaking. Because what we will see very soon now is that a certain number of core nations will rule continental Europe. Not 27, but a lot less than that. Yes, we have 27 member states right now, all of which are called upon to ratify the Lisbon Treaty. Now, again, the Irish people have rejected it, and unless they can be convinced to do it, that Lisbon Treaty is dead. Then what? Well, there's already much talk right now about, as you might have heard it, a Europe of two speeds, or core nations, which are to rule the rest of Europe. Now remember what Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar he saw in that dream. The statue with 10 toes. And also the other vision we talked about, we were talking about 10 horns. And so the Bible speaks about 10 nations, or groups of nations, not 27 or more. And in today's vocabulary, we might call them 10 core nations, or groups of nations. Now, this is not some way out concept. It's actually something which already exists, if you think about it. Der Spiegel, which is another, of course, very popular German magazine, wrote on June 16, 2008, and I quote, Luxembourg Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker said that it was time for a club of the few. Former German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer, who I believe is now teaching somewhere here in the United States, likewise wrote that, quote, those who want political integration should move forward, and those who are happy with just a common market should be left behind. And as I already alluded to, a core Europe already exists. Der Spiegel Online wrote on December 19, 2005. When EU, or European finance ministers, meet, the 12 ministers from the Eurozone, that is those who have already accepted the Euro, hold talks among themselves before they meet the other colleagues whose countries haven't adopted the Euro. In that pre-meeting, the most important decisions for the Eurozone are made. In other words, they're already making those decisions. The others are then walking behind that. Mark Leonard, the one I quoted earlier, wrote in his book, Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century, there are already 3 ambitious projects that do not include all of the European members. The Eurozone, which only 12 countries have joined. The Schengen Agreement, which allows passport-free travel between 15 countries. And the Western European Union, which is Europe's defense identity, which has 10 full members. Listen to this statement, which was published in the Berliner Zeitung, which of course is a German magazine, which was published in the city of Berlin, dated July 2, 2008. The idea of a core Europe or a two-speed Europe is not at all the heresy that some make it out to be. It has long been reality. Many states do not participate in one of the key issues of European integration, the single currency. Now, there is also strong historical and biblical indication that Great Britain will not be part of the final unification of Europe. The EU Observer hinted at this development, and they wrote in March of 2007, the EU should go ahead and further integrate without the UK if it attempts to block a new constitutional treaty, Belgium's Prime Minister Guy Verhofstadt has said. He added, in that case, the European Union must progress without Great Britain. The Wall Street Journal wrote on May 24, 2007, that Mrs. Merkel, the present German Chancellor, Mrs. Merkel's team considers Britain one of the biggest obstacles to any agreement. And according to a statement by former German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt in 2004, core Europe, he said, might not include Britain, but he thinks it will include the original member states, i.e. France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. So it's highly likely that Britain will not be part of core Europe. It's already not part of the Eurozone. I mean, they have not adopted the Euro, as you will know. Now, in order to go further as to what is happening in Europe and why it is happening, I'd like to go now to another biblical scripture in the book of Revelation, chapter 17. Because there, John is given another vision, describing a beast with 10 horns. Actually, that beast is also ridden by a woman. But let's talk about those 10 horns first. He writes, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour, which is, of course, in biblical terminology, a short time, with the beasts. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beasts. These will make war with the Lamb. The Lamb, of course, a symbolic description of Jesus Christ. They will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. Now remember the statue Nebuchadnezzar saw, where this stone smashes the 10 feet, destroys them. He believed that 10 kings will try to conquer Jesus Christ when he returns, but will be defeated. So we see again the same concepts in the book of Revelation described as Daniel had described it earlier. But then John goes on in the book of Revelation chapter 17 to describe this beast a little bit more closely. And it's different from the one which he had described and seen earlier in chapter 13. This one is a scarlet colored beast. The one in 13 is not, insofar as the color is concerned, doesn't mention one way or the other. Now it also has 7 heads, it has 10 horns, but this beast is ridden by a woman. The first beast in Revelation 13 was not. It's interesting how this woman is identified. It says in Revelation 17, verse 5, it's called Mystery, Babylon the Great. In verse 18, it's identified as a city that reigns over the kings of the earth. In verse 9, it said that that city sits on 7 mountains, or other translations have it, 7 hills. Now, it's called Babylon here, but it's very clear from the context that what's being described is the 7-hilled city of Rome, which is actually the successor to ancient Babylon, politically, militarily, economically, and religiously. We're also told that the 7 heads of the beast are 7 kings or 7 kingdoms. And as we will see, these are not contemporaneous kingdoms, but successive ones, one following the other. Now, listen how the Ryrie Study Bible describes this city, this woman riding the beast, which is an economic power and which is a religious power. The Ryrie Study Bible writes, though the famous city of Babylon was on the Euphrates River, the name seems to be a symbolic reference to Rome. In chapter 18, it represents more the political and commercial aspects of the, notice, revived Roman Empire. Thus, the term stands both for a city and for a religious and commercial system related to the city, much like Wall Street is both a place and a system. Halley's Bible Handbook, and you might have heard of this very famous commentary, agrees with the assessment, but it goes a step further. It says, and I quote, the description of Babylon the Great exactly fits papal Rome. Nothing else in world history fits. The Unger Bible Handbook says, the woman denotes a religious system. The woman has her headquarters in the beast's capital, which is the 7-hilled city of Rome. Now, notice that it is the 7 last revivals of the Roman Empire, you might call it the 7 heads of the beast in Revelation 17, which are ridden by the woman, that religious power. See, the first 3 were not. The first 3 revivals occurred under leaders with a different religion, that of Arianism, which was called a heresy by, of course, the Roman Catholic Church. But the last 7 of the 10 revivals occur or will occur under the control with the approval of the Church of Rome. Now again, let me prove what I just said by just looking at the facts, the historical facts. Let's look at the first of the 7 last resurrections of the Roman Empire, which, as we know, occurred under Justinian in AD 554. He was the one mainly responsible for wiping out the barbarian tribes, or 3 barbarian powers. But he did so at the behest of his wife, who was a devout Catholic, and a succession of Roman popes. The second of the 7 last resurrections occurred under Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, or Karl der Große. He was crowned in AD 800 by Pope Leo III in the famous German city of Aachen. Now, the name of the empire, which he was the emperor of, became known as the Holy Roman Empire. Holy, because now you have a connection between church and state. The third of the last seven resurrections occurred under Otto the Great, under whose name the title Holy Roman Empire of the German Nation was coined, because Otto the Great was a German. He was crowned in 962 by Pope John the 12th. The fourth of the seven last resurrections occurred under Charles V of Habsburg. He was crowned in 1530 by Pope Clement the 7th. The fifth resurrection of the last seven occurred under Napoleon Bonaparte. He was crowned on the day of Christmas by Pope Pius the 7th. And you might have heard the story, or even seen the picture, when Napoleon actually took the crown out of the Pope's hands and put it on his head himself, because there was always a struggle going on between state and church, and everybody wanted to make sure that they were ruling the other. The sixth of the seven last resurrections occurred under Hitler and Mussolini. Now let me explain why I say that. Because neither Hitler nor Mussolini were crowned by a pope. But nevertheless, a close partnership did exist between the city of Rome under Pope Pius XII and Italy and Germany. In this partnership, Mussolini signs a famous Lateran Treaty, or Lateran Pacts, with the papacy in 1929, establishing papal sovereignty over Vatican City. This event affirmed Roman Catholicism as the only religion of Italy, which is still the case today, and in turn, the papacy officially recognized Mussolini as the rightful Italian governor. Later, Mussolini proclaimed that he had revived the Roman Empire, and he called himself Roman Emperor. Also, the Vatican signed a concordat with Hitler in 1933, which protected the rights of the church under the Nazi regime. And of course, this gave Hitler's government an outward semblance of legitimacy. Now, I'd like to quote to you from CNews, which is a Catholic news agency. That's what they wrote on February 10, 2004. Vatican City, this week, celebrated its 75th anniversary as a sovereign city. Wednesday, February 11, 2004, marks the anniversary of the signing of the Lateran Pacts or Treaties in 1929. The Lateran Pacts or Treaties established the sovereign Vatican City-State, made Catholicism the official religion of Italy, and regulated church-state relations. The 1929 treaties also established the international character of the Holy See, meaning that now the Holy See could send ambassadors to other countries. Der Stern, again this German magazine I quoted earlier, said in February 10, 2004, the treaty served as a signal for Adolf Hitler, who signed 4 years later a concordat with the Catholic Church. And the article pointed out that both the Catholic Church and Mussolini's government profited from the treaty, and that the Catholic Church, and I quote now, supported the fascist propaganda. And if you studied history and as what happened in World War II in Nazi Germany, you know that that statement is accurate. As with the previous six resurrections, the woman, that city of Rome, which is built on seven hills, will rise, that is, it will influence to one degree or another the activities of the seventh at last resurrection of core Europe, which we are seeing progressing right now. And that too was prophesied in Daniel's visions of those four beasts, which we have read earlier about. See, the fourth beast having 10 horns. We know now that the 10 horns picture the 10 resurrections of the ancient Roman Empire. But in Daniel 7 and in verse 8, Daniel sees something else. It says, I was considering the 10 horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. Now, who or what is that little horn? Who or what are those 3 horns which were plucked out by the roots when this little horn came up? An angel was sent to Daniel to explain. And he says in verse 24 of the same chapter, the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom. And another shall arise after them. Now that doesn't necessarily mean after all of them. It could mean, and it does in this case, after some of them. So another one, this little horn, shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. And as we have already explained, it was responsible for the demise of the first three resurrections of the Roman Empire, those three barbarian tribes which were of a different religion, that of Arianism. He goes on to say, and he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. This little horn, a religious power, and I'm saying this right now, it will become clear, which is synonymous with the woman riding the beast, would change times and law, or rather, the law regarding times, regarding holy times, if you please. Because John also sees this little horn described in the book of Revelation, chapter 13. Now, that was a chapter where John saw this beast with seven heads, looking like a bear and a lion and a leopard and so on. But in verses 11 to 17, he describes a second beast, which comes right after the first. And that second beast is a religious power, because it claims to speak on behalf of and for the Lamb, Jesus Christ. It performs great signs, even making fire coming down from heaven in the sight of men. And he goes on to say, and I quote, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, that no man may buy or sell except one who has a mark or the name of the first beast or the number of his name. Now, the number is identified as 666. I'm not going to go an awful lot into this, but let me just say that in the Greek, every letter has a numerical value. And if you look at the founder of Rome, the Roman Empire, his name is Latinos. And if you look at the name Latinos, and if you start counting the numerical value of that name, you come to 666. In addition, though, I would suggest that the last leader of the Roman Empire, who hasn't arrived yet, but I feel will soon, his name somehow will also bring about this number 666. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the mark of the beast. Now, what's that? See, the mark comes from the first beast. But it's the second beast which causes all people to accept it. Now, we can get a clue about its character from what has gone before in the Roman Empire and its revivals. Notice what historian Will Durant says in his book, The Age of Faith, Volume 4, in his work, The Story of Civilization, when he describes the Code of Justinian. And I quote, this code enacted Orthodox Christianity into law. It acknowledged the ecclesiastical leadership of the Roman Church and ordered all Christian groups to submit to her authority. Heretics were to be put to death, and other dissenters were to suffer confiscation of their goods and were declared, notice, incompetent to buy or sell, to inherit or bequeath. They were excluded from public office, forbidden to meet, and disqualified from suing Orthodox Christians for debt. So those who were not considered to be Orthodox Christians were forbidden from buying or selling, that is, conducting business. Remember, the little horn intended to change times and laws. Indeed, to change the law regarding holy times. And it persecuted those who didn't accept that change. Now, God has clearly commanded in his word that certain times are to be kept holy, and that during those holy times we are not to engage in commerce. But the little horn changed those times, replacing God's holy times with times designated by man to be holy. So we can already deduct from this that a very obvious aspect of the mark of the beast is that it evolves and revolves around worship days, which will impact our ability to buy and to sell. And it says that the little horn, the woman riding the beast, will cause people to accept that mark. Now, the Bible is very clear what days God made holy, which is none other than the weekly Sabbath, which is the time from Friday sunset to Saturday sunset. And there are also certain annual holy days which are mentioned in Scripture. But there is a religious power which has changed, or which has influenced political powers to change, those laws regarding holy time. Let me read to you from the Convert's Catechism of Catholic Doctrine, which was published in 1946. Question: why do we observe Sunday instead of Saturday? Answer: we observe Sunday instead of Saturday because the Catholic Church transferred the solemnity from Saturday to Sunday. In the late 19th century, famous Archbishop James Cardinal Gibbons challenged the Protestants for their refusal to accept the Roman Catholic Church's authority over biblical matters. Remember, the Protestants had said after the Reformation, we only accept the Bible as our own only leader, and we are not going to accept anything outside the Bible. And Gibbons said, now if you do that, then you have a problem. Because he wrote in the Catholic Mirror, which was published in 1893, will they, the Protestants, keep the Sabbath of the Lord, the seventh day according to Scripture? Or will they keep Sunday according to the traditions of the Catholic Church? God's written word enjoins this worship to be observed on Saturday, absolutely, repeatedly, most emphatically, with the most positive threat of death of him to him who disobeys. This teacher, he talks about the Bible, most emphatically forbids any change in the day for paramount reasons. He goes on to say, the Catholic Church for over 1,000 years before the existence of the Protestants, by virtue of her divine mission, changed the day from Saturday to Sunday. The Protestants accept the teaching of the Catholic Church in direct opposition to the plain, unvaried, and constant teaching of their sole teacher, meaning the Bible, in the most essential doctrine of their religion. Now, that's quite an admission. And let's look now how historically this was enforced. How was it determined whether somebody kept the Sabbath and didn't worship on Sunday? But I have a book at home. It's titled A General History of the Sabbatarian Churches. And it has the following record about Sabbath-keeping Waldenses, who lived, of course, in continental Europe hundreds of years ago. At the time of the Spanish Inquisition. It says, a Dominican inquisitor, in giving an account of the proceedings of that infernal tribunal in the north of Spain, talking about the Spanish Inquisition, declares that since it was known that many of the heretics were accustomed to solemnize the old Sabbaths by religious worship and an absolute inattention to secular employments on the Sabbath, it became the policy of the Holy Office to take notice of such shops as were shut up on that day and of such persons as were found to be absent from worldly engagements, again on the Sabbath. The result answered my expectations, he continues, for when those people were arrested and being brought before me, were shown the rack, they generally confessed their Judaical practices, at least as far as it related to Sabbatizing, which the Holy Church had expressly forbidden. So we see, the little horn, the woman that rides that scarlet-colored beast, has been around for a long time. It has changed times and laws. So much so that in Europe, when you buy a calendar over there in Europe, you will find, to your surprise perhaps, that it designates Sunday, not Saturday, but Sunday, as the last day of the week. Now, when you get a calendar here, it will make it clear that Saturday is the last day of the week, Sunday the first day, but not so in Europe anymore. There the people are made to believe that Sunday actually is the last day of the week, the quote-unquote Christian Sabbath. Now, we hear a lot today about religious cooperation between sister churches. But the Catholic Church has made it very clear, and it is a long-standing doctrinal position, that every and all churches outside the Roman Catholic Church are not, quote-unquote, sister churches. Instead, the Catholic Church considers itself as the only true church of Jesus Christ, and it looks upon those other churches as needing to return to the fold of the Roman Catholic Church. Notice what Reuters reported on July 10, 2007. The Vatican said that Christian denominations outside the Roman Catholic Church were not full churches of Jesus Christ. The Vatican said other churches are quote-unquote wounded since they do not recognize the primacy of the Pope. The 10 core nations or groups of nations in Europe will be guided, will be influenced by the religious system of Europe, which is headquartered in the city of the Seven Hills. You see, in the sense, the Roman Catholic Church has been influencing the European unification, the one we are talking about, which is progressing right now. It has been influencing that all along. The British magazine and newspaper The Telegraph wrote in 1991. The common market, you see, that's of course a pre-runner of the European Union as we have it today. The common market itself started under the inspiration of Catholic politicians, such as Konrad Adenauer of Germany, Paul Henry Spaak, Jean Monnet, and Robert Schuman. They were all deeply influenced by Catholic social teaching. Monnet, for example, believed in the Catholic vision that Europe should become a federal superstate. The Financial Times wrote in May of 1994 that the idea of a united Europe has been viewed as essentially a Catholic concept. But at this point, there is still not agreement, specifically amongst many of the European people, to actually build that kind of a European unification, and especially not under Catholic leadership. However, the Bible gives us an important reason why this is going to happen. Why ultimately, and I would say not that far from now, and that long from now, Europeans will embrace wholeheartedly such a coming European unification under the lead of two strong and charismatic personages. And let me also say, when that happens, that is not going to be good news for the United States of America, as I will explain in a moment. Because, you see, the final configuration of the last revival of the Roman Empire will kind of mirror what happened in the previous revival under Hitler and Mussolini. And I'm talking about the fact that the previous revival undoubtedly was infiltrated by demonic forces. Now again, many people don't even believe in demons today. They don't believe in Satan today. They believe that's kind of an imaginary phenomenon, but the Bible makes it very clear that there is a Satan and that there are demons. And we can say safely today that Adolf Hitler was demonically possessed, and that many of the Germans who actually followed him without any question were moved, let's say, by this demonic influence. Klaus Fischer wrote a book titled Nazi Germany, A New History, which I picked up at Barnes & Noble not too long ago. He has much to say about the personal life of Adolf Hitler. He described a very interesting incident which took place when Hitler was only 17 years old. He said his only friend in Linz, which was in Austria, where Hitler lived at the time, Gustl Kubitschek, reports that Adolf enjoyed speechifying for him while the two friends were walking through deserted fields. One night, Hitler led his friend atop a steep hill. With his feverish excitement, he began speaking in a strange, raspy voice that didn't seem to belong to him. According to Kubitschek, Hitler seemed possessed by his own, and he uses the word daemon, which is Greek for demon. Adolf believes that he was singled out to play a providential role in world history must have sounded strange to his young friend. The author goes on to say, and I quote, "It is well known that Hitler believed that he possessed the rare gift of prophetic sight, or Vorsehung in German, and based some crucial decisions on this presumed insight. He sensed invisible demonic forces all around him." Hitler's anti-Semitism, Fischer tells us, went beyond prejudice. It must be ranked with witchcraft and demonology in the history of the human race. Hitler called his invasion of Poland Teufelswerk, which means the work of the devil. And he made a remarkable statement in 1938 when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced that he wanted to visit him. And I quote again from Fischer's book on Nazi Germany. On September 13th, Chamberlain dispatched a telegram to Hitler suggesting a personal meeting with the Führer in hopes of peacefully resolving the Czechoslovakian crisis. The prospect of being visited by a British Prime Minister 20 years his senior, making his first flight to see him, immensely appealed to Hitler's vanity. Ich bin vom Himmel gefallen, meaning I fell from heaven. he reportedly exclaimed after receiving Chamberlain's telegram. Now, this is not an expression known in the German language. Being from Germany myself, I can assure you, that is totally unprecedented. But there is a personage which fell from heaven. Jesus Christ himself says that he saw Satan falling from heaven like lightning, indicating who actually spoke through Adolf Hitler. When it was all over, notice the state the people of Germany were left in. And I quote again, "Germans now released from the spell were dumbfounded by what had happened to them. Karl Jaspers, a professor of philosophy, summed it all up well by confessing that, quote, during the past 12 years, something has happened to us that seems like the remolding of our entire being. To put it in the form of an image, devils have been raining blows upon us and have swept us away, together with themselves, into a chaos which has robbed us of sight and hearing. We have experienced something like the witchcraft madness of the latter Middle Ages." You see, people worshipped Hitler. They thought he was their savior. They called him their savior, the one who would save them. They said Heil Hitler to him. But you see, Hitler didn't perform any miracles. The only miracle, perhaps, you might associate with him is the fact that people tried to kill him, and they weren't able to, until finally Hitler killed himself in the bunker, committing suicide. But he didn't fulfill any or do any miracle himself. But you see, there's going to be an end-time religious figure. He will perform miracles, and we read in God's Word that he will thereby deceive most people. Now, that's nothing new in history either. I picked up another book from Barnes & Noble. It's called Millennium Prophecies. And let me just quote from that book. The author writes, amongst other personages, about the Sumerian-born famous Simon Magus, the one who's actually even mentioned in the book of Acts. He lived from about 15 BC to 53 AD. And now this is what the legends have it. That is what people believe he did. He performed many miracles, including healing the sick, raising the dead, walking through fire, flying through the air, turning stones into bread, creating phantom banquets, making himself invisible, animating stone statues, changing his own shape, and of course, reputedly commanding elemental spirits or possibly demons to do his bidding. Now, I'm not saying he did all of that thing, but I'm saying this is what people felt and thought he did. He is called in the book of Acts the great sorcerer, and people followed him because he had these great powers as a sorcerer. Now, the book Millennium Prophecies also tells us about another famous sorcerer, Pope Sylvester II. He lived at the end of the first century. And I quote from his book, "Tradition has it that he was an advanced student of the black arts. It was said that he regularly conversed with the devil. He was credited with possessing a brazen head that spoke to him and could prophesy future events. He learned to summon ghostly figures from the lower world. The demons obeyed him in all that he required of them day and night because of the great sacrifices which he offered." Now again, I'm not saying all of this actually happened, but I'm saying this is what people believed happened. And quite frankly, I don't doubt that some of that actually did happen, because we've seen it, this is what happened to and with Adolf Hitler and those who followed him. And they were heavily involved in black magic, as we know. And so we see that a future religious leader, called the false prophet, will be able to perform mighty miracles. And many will be deceived by those signs and will follow the wrong teachings of this man and the system that he represents. But let me ask again, how could this affect us here in the United States, living far away from continental Europe? How could, for instance, the mark of the European beast affect us over here? Well, first of all, we have recently seen, perhaps if you put a certain historical pointer at it, with the beginning of the Iraq War, you have seen an increased deterioration of the relationships between the United States and Europe. But things will get much worse, and let me tell you, it's totally unimportant from that standpoint who the next American president will be, because the Bible tells us things will get much worse, one way or the other. Remember, the U.S. did get drawn into and become involved in World War I and in World War II because of events which were going on in Europe. The Bible shows us that the U.S. will again end up at odds with Europe. The U.S. will get involved again. Now, we don't know the exact reasons for the coming controversy between those two power blocks, but we do know that a future war between the United States of America and continental Europe, once they have united under the leadership of those 10 core nations, is prophesied. Now, you might ask yourself the question, why? Why would God allow that to happen? And we have a booklet prepared which is titled The Fall and Rise of Britain and America, where we give some answers from the Bible. Here I want to say that Europe will also enforce its mark on the United States. Now, in a sense, that's not that surprising, because most Americans already today believe in Orthodox Christianity. The most powerful bloc of voters today consists of Catholics. We have already blue laws today in parts of the United States, but we have also protection still, which we don't have in the United States. We have protection that, for instance, those who want to keep the Sabbath can do so. They are allowed to get accommodation on the job market. They don't have to send their children to school for religious reasons and so on. But we also see that the American Constitution, which guarantees free exercise of religion, is being more and more ignored and even violated by our courts and governmental agencies already today. But as we have seen, America is losing its standing towards the European Union in economic and other matters, which is already happening. And as I said, once those 10 European core nations have been fully united, a war between those two power blocks will come. Now, that's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that anyone would dare to attack the United States. But the Bible clearly prophesies it's going to happen, and it wouldn't be the first time in history that such a concept has been considered. You might have heard that the German Emperor Wilhelm II wanted to attack New York and Boston around 1900. Now, he wasn't able to do so, but he was planning to do so. Adolf Hitler wanted to attack the United States during World War II. Again, it didn't come to that. However, Japan did, at Pearl Harbor. Recently, terrorists did, on September 11, 2001. Now, Europe's goal is to build a powerful, unified European army. And recently, French President Nicolas Sarkozy has said that if the Lisbon Treaty would have been already in force and effect, Europe could have powerfully stood up to and responded to Russia's aggressions and invasion of Georgia. Angela Merkel, German Chancellor, has said as early as March 24, 2007, as reported in the Times, that a common European army could help to bind countries closer together. It's clearly Europe's goal to have a unified, powerful army. And the goal undoubtedly is to create an army for the purpose of defense, should Europe be attacked by Russia or Iran, for example. However, as America has shown recently, an army can also be used for offensive purposes, and you might call it preemptive war. Nevertheless, that's what Europe is going to do, according to biblical prophecy. Now, that may be hard to visualize, I grant you that, at this point. But who would have thought that Hitler would have invaded Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland? Nobody believed it at the time. Nobody wanted to believe it. Who would have thought later that Russia would have invaded Czechoslovakia in 1963? And recently, Georgia. Who is believing that perhaps we are going to see a war very soon, ignited by an attack of Israel against Iran? Something which is being discussed very, very strongly in the press. All of that happened, didn't it? And we also find a prevailing anti-Americanism in many European countries. Now, they may call it anti-Bush, but it has far exceeded feelings about the current president. How are we to evaluate, and I quote now Der Spiegel, German hypocritical feelings of anti-Americanism, as they put it, in March of 2007, stating that 48% of Germans think that the United States is more dangerous and a greater threat to world peace than Iran. And just the other day I picked up a German magazine which said that even today Germans think that Bush is more dangerous than Putin. Times Online published an interesting article on August 24, 2008, wondering whether the world is facing another global war. And it said, and I quote, "The world is showing alarming parallels with the 1930s. As the world again approaches depression, history shows that going to war is a result of weak, short-sighted leaders entrapped by a series of mistakes. For the West's leaders at present, mistake has become second nature." And what we are seeing right now are the beginning stages of the United States of Europe forming right in front of our eyes. And its unification of 10 nations, core nations, groups of nations, is complete. When its power and its authority is given, handed over to a still future influential political leader, perhaps under the name of the President of the United States of Europe, and he will work hand in hand with a mighty religious figure who is able to perform miracles, who is called the false prophet in the book of Revelation, we will know that the time is short. We will be entering the time which the Bible calls in the book of Matthew the Great Tribulation. A time so serious, Jesus said, unless he would intervene, unless those days would be shortened, no human being would be saved alive. The European charismatic military leader will only rule for a very short time, about an hour as we read in Scripture, but he will create much devastation during his rule. He will attack the United States. He will invade the Middle East, the city of Jerusalem. Scriptures in the book of Daniel, I haven't even talked about tonight, point that out. Our booklet, European Prophecy, gives you those scriptures. He will be provoked to respond with a military attack against countries such as Russia and China. Now, thinking of Hitler and Mussolini, you can see that they all did most of that, but they didn't invade the Holy Land. That's something the leader of the last resurrection of the Roman Empire will do. But there is also good news. I said at the beginning of the lecture that, in fact, it is kind of a positive news, even though you will be hearing about some grim statistics and facts and historical records. But you see, when all of this happens, and we can see how it's coming together already, Christ's return will be imminent. It is in the days of those last 10 kings, or those toes in Nebuchadnezzar's image, of those last 10 European core nations or groups of nations, those horns of the beast in Revelation 17, that the God of heaven will set up a kingdom here on earth. It shall not be destroyed. That's part of the gospel message. It's a message of the good news of the coming kingdom of God, which needs to be proclaimed today, because Christ tells us that when that gospel message of the kingdom of God is proclaimed in all the world, then the end shall come. And you who have been here tonight, and you who have been listening over the internet, have heard it proclaimed. Now, again, to help you understand more as to what is actually described in the Bible, we are preparing a book. It's not just a booklet, it's a book, 160, 170 pages long, about the book of Revelation, which will go through the chapters, chapter by chapter, to explain what is being described. We hope to have this ready within a month or so for circulation. If you want a copy, just let us know, and we'll put you on our list. And so I thank you very much for your attention for tonight. And that is all I'd like to say tonight, and kept you long enough. And if there are any questions, please feel free to even ask me personally, or if you got any questions over the chat line, let me know. Otherwise, I wish you a great evening, and thanks for coming, and thanks for your interest.